wrong.
So I call this lecture Ricci Flow and Renormalization 2. Well, that's because I gave a lecture called Ricci Flow and Renormalization in December. And so in December, I kind of got partway through what I was going to do, and I promised you I would come back and finish it up. And that promise still holds, but that's not what today's lecture is. So in the meantime, there was a paper which actually came out on New Year's Eve. HEP-TH-06-12-296 from Saitlin, called On Sigma Model RG Flow, Central Charge Action, and Perelman's Entropy. So what I want to do today is explain kind of the general program outlined in that paper. And maybe I'll start to get to the continuation of the talk from December. But I also know that there's some new faces in the room, so this talk is not going to assume that you were at the previous talk. So what's the basic setup? The basic setup here, well, from a geometer's point of view, what we would like to do is to consider some kind of manifold M equipped with a Riemannian metric. But we're actually going to let the set of all possible Riemannian metrics be a parameter space here. So we're interested in the set of all possible Gij, Riemannian metric on M. And one of the things which Perelman taught us, and which the physicists understood for a different reason earlier on, is that you should actually supplement this space with some additional data. So the case I'm going to consider today looks like this. It'll be the set of pairs consisting of a Riemannian metric on M and a real-valued function on M. Now, all the computations are going to be local computations on M today, and the results, I mean, the things that will be stated are at the physics level of rigor. And, of course, if one were to try to make mathematically precise statements out of a lot of these things, you'd have to worry about, compactness conditions, or if not compact, some kind of growth at infinity for both Gij and phi. I'm not going to think about any of those things today at all. We're just going to work locally, so we can treat M as kind of a local piece of curved manifold, and we'll try to understand this structure. So the idea of the nonlinear sigma model. So nonlinear sigma models, as I explained in the earlier lecture about renormalization, so it's a two-dimensional quantum field theory which uses the choice of metric and function on the manifold M as sort of data for writing down the theory. So the action for the theory, which depends on a map X from the so-called world sheet of the two-dimensional sigma model, so this is a two-manifold, to the target manifold M. That action takes the general form, well, let's see. So some people tend to put the alpha prime into the action, and since I'm following Saitlin, I'll do that today. The terms that you get look like the pullback of Gij, look like the norm squared of dx evaluated in an L2 norm using the metrics GIJ on capital GIJ on the target, and there's some implicit metric on the source. So sigma should come with a metric little g AB, typically speaking. And then there's another term, which is the integral of the composition of x and phi times the curvature of the world sheet metric. So this is curvature of GAB, and maybe that needs a dVol or something like that to have something to integrate. So that's a typical mathematician's way of writing down the function. Physicists would typically write a bunch of indices. Should I write them down? Sure. So it would look like d2x root g GAB partial in the A direction, so that's thought of as a world sheet coordinate. So here I'm just writing down what this L2 norm term is, and then, sorry, if I put the alpha prime there, I should put it here as well. And then I get an alpha prime times this curvature term times just phi of x. So we have this rather large space of pairs, G and phi, and the problem is that the sort of naive physical properties which you would want a theory like this to have, it doesn't have if you insist on using, say, an actual two-dimensional manifold, which is compact or something like that. The quantities which typically you want to evaluate in the two-dimensional quantum field theory don't make sense. They lead to divergent expressions sort of directly. And the solution to that is to have some kind of regularization scheme and also some kind of renormalization program for both rendering the integrals finite, and then in renormalization for taking certain divergent quantities which you might calculate out of these integrals and figuring out what sort of order of pole they have in the parameter and subtracting off the polar term and getting some kind of finite answer. So it all sounds a little hokey to mathematicians, but in fact, as in some future lecture in this series, I'll try to explain in more detail. There are some well-defined procedures which lead to well-defined mathematical answers. So the idea is, having picked some kind of measure of approximation that we're making to what we really want to do. So the two-dimensional quantum field theories are going to involve expressions involving the exponential of this action together with some other functions of x, typically integrated over the space of all maps. And those are the things that we're trying to make some kind of sense of. Maybe there's a minus sign. Those are the things that we're trying to make some kind of sense of. In so doing, we make approximations, and we let T denote some kind of approximation scale, renormalization group scale. So it's sometimes called renormalization group time. And for any particular value of renormalization group time, I can sort of use this interesting method of changing the approximation. So I sort of take t plus delta t. And I notice that there's some change in the value of the integral by making this change in approximation. So what is this kind of approximation that I'm talking about? Perhaps I've done some kind of Fourier expansion of this guy, and I'm only taking the Fourier modes between some lower and some upper bound, and now I'm changing the effect of those bounds. It turns out that in this general class of problems, one can, having changed the scale at which one is looking, correct for any difference in the answer by changing the values of the parameters GIJ and phi. So GIJ is supposed to go to, so GIJ, which had some value at t, is supposed to now have some value at t plus delta t. Similarly, phi, which we regarded perhaps as depending on t, is going to change a little bit into phi plus of t plus delta t in such a way that the overall change, so this change in our approximation scheme, together with these changes in the parameters, leaves the actual integrand or quantities like this, the integral over the set of maps, invariant in some form. And this process of following, so this in the limit gives some sort of differential equation. It tells us that the derivative of gij should be some particular quantity, and the derivative of phi should be some particular quantity. And those two things together determine some kind of flow in this space. We can imagine flow lines in this space, which are determined by sort of tracking different levels of approximation to the actual physical integral. And then, as I think I explained in the first lecture, the sort of goal is to figure out what the fixed points of this flow might be. So typically one hopes that these flow lines are going to be converging in on something, and it's those kinds of fixed points which are really interesting for describing the ultimate physical theory.
So this is some kind of gradient flow coming from I?
At the moment, it's not a gradient flow. At the moment, it's so you have to calculate it. You have to have settled on ways of rendering these integrals finite to some approximation, and then change that approximation. The whole point of today's lecture is that, in fact, we want the flow to be a gradient flow, and we're going to turn it into a gradient flow. So the connection to the work of Perelman, first of all, is that the one loop computation for the change in metric was the Ricci tensor, and basically the one loop, I haven't said what that means yet, but anyway, some approximation to this flow was the Ricci flow. And Perelman taught us that Ricci flow, which had been studied without the benefit of a gradient flow interpretation, can actually be rewritten as a gradient flow if you're careful and if you include a dilaton in an appropriate sense. And what Salen has done is extended that to the arbitrary case. So it's not just the Ricci flow situation. It's in fact the general case that the physics
would like. What's the meaning of the fixed point of this positive flow?
Well, if you had a fixed point of the flow, then of course you'd be in a situation where the approximation scheme, basically the distance scale at which the approximation was valid, wouldn't matter. And those are expected to be the conformally invariant theories. So this is a way of locating conformally invariant quantum field theories as the fixed points of this flow. Now, there's some sort of rough classification of what kind of conformally invariant two-dimensional theories there could be, and for lots of cases you would just expect a trivial physical theory. There is some conformally invariant theory in which nothing interesting happens.
This I is not conformally invariant?
I is not conformally invariant.
But the reason is because of this extra term, right? If you only have...
No. Even without... I mean, it's not conformally invariant. So it's conformally invariant to one loop order if capital Gij is Ricci flat. So the conformal invariance, the first approximation to conformal invariance is measured by this calculation of the change of Gij with respect to this renormalization change. And that's going to be, in just a minute, the Ricci tensor. Plus...
But that energy term is conformally invariant. With respect to world symmetry?
Conformally invariant on the world sheet.
Okay. So you want components on the capital G. Okay.
No, I want conformal invariance on the world sheet.
You want
little G.
On little G, but that energy is a conformally invariant on the classical.
The regression principle.
So the real trouble is...
Yeah, I guess the real point is that you can't do without this dilaton term somehow. I mean, you can solve for it as a function of the metric, but in the quantum theory, you can't do without the dilaton term. It turns out that when you vary according to these kind of general renormalization principle.
Ivan Kerr correction, do you mean that term?
No.
So the real trouble is in that term or in something else?
Well, so this term is forced on you in the quantum theory.
But because of this term, I mean the non-conforming invariance, because of this term.
The reason I am hesitating to say yes is that you'll then say, well, leave it out. And I'm trying to tell you that you can't leave it out. But yes, it's because of that term.
Okay. And then you want to recover conforming invariance.
That's right. You want conformal invariance of the quantum theory rather than just the classical theory. Okay, so as I sort of sketched very briefly when I talked about this in December, there's this specific method. First of all, you use so-called dimensional regularization to make sense of the integrals, and then you have to use the so-called minimal subtraction renormalization scheme to think about how to make these changes in the parameters as you vary the fineness of the approximation that's being discussed. But the results of those computations are as follows. So let's just define the g part of the beta function to just be whatever I got from my renormalization scheme there. And the phi part of the beta function to be the similar thing for phi. And then the result of some computations that were made, well, I started to describe Friedan's computation, but then, in fact, people made computations at higher order. So the idea here is going to be there's an alpha prime in this exponential. The idea is to expand these quantities in alpha prime and to understand order by order in alpha prime what the meaning is. And so the result turned out to be that the beta function starts out as the Ricci tensor. And then just to have another term in the whole story written out explicitly, it looks like a contraction of the Riemann tensor. Like this. And then any other terms are cubic in this alpha prime expansion parameter and cubic in the curvatures. Well, that just means they involve somehow cubic expressions in curvatures. So, as I said, this is supposed to be something like an asymptotic or a power series expansion in this parameter alpha prime, and the result that we were focused on before, which is what made the connection initially between Perelman's work and the work of Hamilton and and the work of Friedan and others in two-dimensional quantum field theories was this one-loop approximation, but there are higher approximations. Now, in the superstring, these first terms aren't there. Turns out that they vanish, but there is, even in the superstring, a non-trivial alpha to the fourth term. So I'm writing things out for the bosonic string in which there are non-trivial terms even at the alpha prime squared and alpha prime cubed level. And in terms of this sort of flow picture, well, it's a difficult situation to be in, right, where you've got some differential equation which somehow depends on an alpha prime which is giving you an approximation to the whole thing. The question being whether you can trust that the kind of gross asymptotic features that you would see for the solutions to the differential equation will continue to hold at different powers of alpha prime. So ultimately, I think one would like to understand how this renormalization business works sort of in general, maybe with the series summed or with some other way of treating it as a function of alpha prime that didn't depend on a perturbation expansion. But at the moment, this is sort of the only thing that we have available. Corresponding to this, there were calculations for the beta function for the dilaton. And the beta function for the dilaton is some initial term which whose value depends on which string theory we're working with. So in the case of the bosonic string, it's 1/6 times D capital D minus 26, and in general it's known as the or it's related to what's called the central charge of the quantum field theory. And then it's got some alpha prime business, so I've got a second derivative of the function phi. I've got curvature terms, contracted slightly differently for the alpha squared, and then again, alpha cubed or cubed for the next term. So these are the kind of known results, and they're going to extend, again in this kind of asymptotic expansion, they're going to extend order by order beyond the Ricci flow case to some family of flows depending somehow on this parameter alpha prime, all of which one hopes are related to each other, at least in terms of their global behavior. And what one would like is to sort of sum this series and then have the fixed point for the summed series. And maybe the summed series also requires some so-called non-perturbative effects, which wouldn't be detected by this approach. But anyway, if I pose it in that way, it's even less of a well-defined mathematical problem. So I think I won't.
Does the theory claim you always have fixed points?
Well, the
for the full theory.
For the full theory, you should always maybe have fixed points, but sometimes those fixed points will be uninteresting physical theories. So they may be described physically by some collection of fields that don't interact whatsoever, so by free fields.
But mathematically, it's not clear at all that you can have a fixed point.
Mathematically, it's not only not clear that you can have a fixed point, but most likely the fixed point, in some sense, lies outside the range of G comma phi's. So somehow, mathematically, what you want to do is identify which flow lines seem to be coming together as you go out towards the ends of that space, and then have some way of analyzing the corresponding physical theory as a sort of common property of those flows.
How do the physicists feel about the situation? Are they just simply arguing, we don't worry, there must be fixed points?
So the physicists know deep in their hearts that there is a fixed point.
What's the foundation for that? What supports that?
But the fixed point might be trivial. I mean,
it doesn't matter.
There's some example of ADS factors.
Yeah, but let's even be more fundamental than that.
Are you talking about the bosonic string here or the super string?
Well, I think I'm talking about the bosonic string.
Because we don't have deep feelings about that.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about just the two-dimensional quantum field theory questions, right?
Then it could be trivial solutions.
Could be trivial solutions, but that's still a fixed point, right? I mean, the idea is that somehow there is some ultimate theory, just to use a little jargon, in the infrared limit of the physical theory, which has some physical description. And I guess the physics point of view is that you made the whole original theory by some kind of mathematical approximation to some underlying physical object, and that physical object is there, and so we're just trying to describe it somehow. And the problem is not being able to tell, without some additional tools, whether the object which lives at the end of these flow lines is an interesting non-trivial object or not. So one of the techniques for trying to determine that has been to find quantities which would either be invariant under the flow or would behave in a very predictable way under the flow, and then to check that those quantities were signals that you've got interesting physics in the infrared. And that's sort of been this indirect approach to studying these conformal field theories.
Some point might be trivial. I wonder how can that be if you have a complicated
By trivial, I mean the physics of the fixed point is trivial.
For example, are Calabi-Yau matrix fixed points for the full
No,
flow?
They're not, because of the alpha prime business. So if
so are there examples of fixed points at all?
No.
For the superstring ADS 5 cross 5, that doesn't solve all the equations in all orders. Is there any proof that should be a solution to all orders in all the time?
Yeah, so...
If the superstring, the Calabi-Yaus are supposed to be fixed points, right?
Well... from the world shape point of view, they can't quite be because it's only to first order an alpha prime.
But there, the alpha prime corrections take a restricted form.
No, they don't vanish on the Calabi-Yaus. There's an alpha prime to the fourth term that doesn't vanish on Calabi-Yaus. There's a special class of hyperkähler manifolds in which they vanish. So there's an example, a K3 surface. Okay, so the K3 surface, all these corrections vanish.
Even the third order,
all the higher order corrections vanish.
R is zero.
Well,
R is
no, no. R is not. R. This is not zero. Maybe this trace of the curvature is zero for K3. I don't remember. The form of the equation is a little bit different in the superstring case. But in the superstring case, whatever the corrections are, they vanish for hyperkähler metrics. So those are examples. But the Calabi-Yau metrics that everybody wants to use, you actually need to make these alpha prime corrections. Nobody knows how to make the alpha prime corrections.
The same as physics are not particularly... saying they want to use hyperkähler manifolds.
They don't want to because it's too much supersymmetry, yes.
Right. So, that's a dilemma.
Well, see, the difference between a mathematician and a physicist is a mathematician says, boy, that's a dilemma. The physicist says, yeah, that's a dilemma. Let's keep going.
You know, I guess that's the difference between the point when you're going to be, you don't want to, that's not where you're going.
What I want to do is show that these guys have gradient flow interpretations, and Salen put in the dilaton but didn't put in the other fields. So I don't know whether you can extend his results in that way. So I'm not going to do that today. Now just to confuse matters slightly, there's a slight variation on these beta function coefficients. And I'm just going to write it down. It doesn't change anything up to diffeomorphism, but... It doesn't change anything up to diffeomorphism, but... people have taken this modified set of conditions. And the reason for doing this is that you can write down something that looks like a gradient flow interpretation for the beta function if you make an appropriate diffeomorphism change of this type. So this is some diffeomorphism of the form, well, its alpha prime term is delta mu phi, and then it's got some other term which only depends on G, and in fact that term has been the first order contribution to that term has been calculated, and it has no alpha squared term in it. So if we only cared about the alpha squared level, we wouldn't have to worry about this diffeomorphism change. Okay, so I'll write down the correct action for that guy in just a second. So there are lots of reasons why one might hope that this picture is given in terms of the gradient flow for some functional on this space of metrics and so-called dilaton fields, functions on the manifold M. So we'd be looking for such a space from the set of all, such a map from the set of all g-phis into the real numbers. And we would hope that if you vary if you vary s with respect to the G mu nu, you would get some kind of, well, I'm running out of indices, so you get some kind of mu nu lambda kappa, kappa lambda, there's a kappa, huh, K-L-M-N, lambda pi, how about that, beta lambda pi g plus some k mu nu phi beta phi. I don't know, what, oh, there has to be a mu nu up here as well. Who knows? And the change with respect to phi would again be some, you know, kappa with some other indices.
So kappa is the coefficient.
There's some coefficient kappa. And so because these differ just by diffeomorphism, if we're going to impose conditions like the change in the metric and the change in the dilaton are changing according to these properties, if we change from beta to beta bar, we can actually kind of get away with making the change with respect to these beta bar guys rather than betas without effectively altering the meaning of the Ricci flow. Okay, so the reason for doing it that way is that there is a nice action so-called central charge action, which you can write as an integral now over the manifold sorry, I didn't copy this one down. An integral over the manifold of C0 minus an alpha prime term quarter times the curvature plus some other terms plus O of alpha prime squared D all M. So we do an integral of this, we try to find a function of this general form where our decision about what to put in the integrand depends on our desire to get the setup working the way it's all written on the board. So you can sort of imagine what the iterative scheme is for figuring out how to extend this in alpha prime. You have to be able to calculate the beta function, as I did, to further orders in alpha prime. And then you want to put in an arbitrary diffeomorphism, which may involve some other quantities in the curvature. And exactly which quantities in the curvature will be sort of determined by the behavior of the beta function here, so that, and put in these terms here so that when you vary these, you get the term that you want, including the beta function term, together with some corrections from the diffeomorphism. So it turns out that if you didn't put in that extra diffeomorphism, you wouldn't be able to write down this action so simply, but you are able to do so using this principle. Now, there's some... Yes? Sure.
I'm a little confused about your alpha prime to the fourth statement. I thought that conformal invariance on the world sheet required the vanishing of these beta functions.
It does.
So if you say that in the superstring it doesn't vanish to all orders...
For a Calabi-Yau. So a Calabi-Yau is a one-loop... conformally invariant model, but it's not conformally invariant to all orders.
Oh, I see. And it's not something that's coordinate invariant. You can't fix
it. No, in fact,
fix it up.
I guess the history, which maybe Joe lived through and remembers, is that people had shown in the case of the superstring that the alpha squared and alpha cube, alpha prime squared and alpha prime cubed terms vanished. And so there was a hope that for all Calabi-Yau manifolds, it was going to be conformally invariant. But then somebody made the calculation of alpha prime to the fourth. Damn. wasn't zero. So in the hyperkettle case it is, but in the general Calabi-Yau case it isn't. You don't remember this, I can tell you from...
I still think it works for Calabi-Yau. I'm confused. I still thought it works for Calabi-Yau, okay. But not for region flat poles that were not complex.
Do you remember, Sergey? Okay. I know you weren't. Gary would know, but he didn't come. Okay, so looks like we've accomplished our goals. So, let me rephrase this and just introduce some sort of fake guy I, and just call these all beta. Actually, sorry.
Excuse me. You say that this R is not R in the beginning. Right? This is R seems to be scalar coverage on the manifold, right? The cavity. The R in the beginning was for the world sheet.
The first R was for the world sheet. This is for
The cavity.
The manifold. That's right.
So what is the rule that world sheet R? It doesn't appear anywhere.
No, the world sheet R was simply multiplying the dilaton when you did the world sheet integral. So the world sheet integral was the thing which got us started and was the thing which needs this renormalization and regularization schemes to decide the meaning of, and which is used to make the calculations of what these beta functions
are. It doesn't appear in any of these formulas. So why does that the trouble term for the theory? Remember you said... the non-conforming invariance was because of that R term.
That's true, it is.
But now you want to somehow fix the problem, you don't have to do anything about that. That looks a little funny. As if you don't have R at all.
I mean, the real issue is whether there's a phi in here, right? I mean, if you could sort of consistently set phi equal to zero. No, you can't consistently set phi equal to zero. That's the problem.
Well, anyway, that R can appear in this equation anyway.
The R is not, but the phi was multiplying it. So I had right. So the integral was integral of phi R dVol.
So right?
R just integrates out. This is sort of keeping track of the phi. So the phi is tracking what happened with that curvature term in the world sheet integral.
The hypothesis is that the Calabi-Yau solutions don't like show that the perturbed equations have perturbed solutions. Is that the issue? I mean, there was some result that even if the equation is perturbed, there's no obstruction to improving the solution.
Right. So what you should expect to find is that you need to correct the Calabi-Yau metric at higher order in the alpha prime expansion.
But it would be a little bit different from where it would be where you.
Well, that's not been proved, right? I mean,
that's what I thought happened.
That's the general philosophy that you expect in this perturbative approach to be able to make these corrections order by order in the two-dimensional expansion. But people had really hoped, I think, that it was going to vanish all the way up, and it does for hyperkähler.
Dave,
yes.
Is it easy to say how to come up with the central charge action? How does that one come up with?
Well, let's see. So let's do it with no alpha prime. So with no alpha prime, the only term without an alpha prime in the whole story is this term. So to get an action which has as its variation with respect to phi, C0, you put in the e to the phi. There's some factor of 2, but I'm off, right? But that's the first term, how you find it. Now we want to do it with alpha prime. So now we've got a Ricci curvature term, we've got a gradient squared phi term, and we're going to allow for a diffeomorphism, and it will turn out that you need this diffeomorphism in alpha prime to make it work. And so you look to see, is there something I can multiply alpha prime by which would give me the right order alpha prime versions of these guys? And the claim is that this does it. So, I mean, it's only from this data that, right? Now, I should say that it's guided by some conservation principle for some vile term in the curvature action, which I've sort of hidden from you to try to avoid having this lecture last too long. So I sort of suppressed that part, and that principle actually makes it easier to figure this out. It's not just order by order. You kind of can see where you can see actually that vile curvature principle makes it clear that you should expect some kind of gradient interpretation for the story. But anyway, just as a kind of exercise, you could imagine trying to write down an expression like this, order by order. So you have to be able to do the computations order by order of the beta function, but once you've done that, the rest follows. Okay, so why don't we just stop here? In fact, this central charge action was written down in the late 80s. The problem is, so I'm having trouble because I decided not to take Salen's shortcut with notation, but let me now do it. So let's let phi sub I be shorthand for all the different components that we're talking about. So the g mu nu's together with the phi, and then I can abbreviate what I want here by writing an expression like this. So I want it beta, this is the beta bar j, as it were. So I want to take the beta function variation, I guess there's a minus sign someplace. We can absorb it into kappa. I want the beta function variation to work like this with some second order guy like that. And by the way, if this is invertible, then you can sort of recover what the beta guys are in this way. And the kappas which are being generated in this sort of scheme actually do form an invertible 2x2 matrix of functions on this space, but not a definite one. So I think with the sign I've got there, I would have wanted it to be negative definite. But the problem is that, let me say, minus kappa ij is not positive definite. So if I had a positive definite set of matrices there, then these flows would have really been just decreasing flows with respect to this function, right? However, here they're kind of saddle flows. So I'm running along saddle points somehow, no matter what I do. And in particular, you won't find quantities which you're guaranteed, you won't find nice quantities which you're guaranteed has a monotonic behavior of decreasing or increasing along the flow, or at least you won't easily find them if you've used this particular action principle.
Does that depend on population, no matter what?
I suppose that statement, I don't actually know. That's right. The first order, that's right. The first order, it's okay. without any alpha primes. So a lot of these vanished to first order, so I'm not even sure I can read off what the kappa is, right? Maybe I need a couple of alpha prime terms before I can even see what it is. Right, so if we look at the derivative, at least with the first few terms I've written down, so of course if you wrote out this integral, it would be an integral over the coordinates on the manifold whose dimension is capital D, which we'd never mentioned before, times some root G, times some, you know, G upper mu nu. We could sort of write it out in coordinates like that, and then the only phi derivative part in this whole story would look like minus 2 times this root g term times e to the minus 2 phi times a beta phi term, and that is supposed to vanish at the critical points. What I forgot to tell you was what this is. So beta phi looked just like this C0 minus alpha prime, whatever. So here it was written as beta phi itself plus some diffeomorphism. And sorry, I erased the beta phi, but in fact, the action can be written as if this were just the thing which goes in the action differs from this beta phi, the guy that was being interpreted there, by this diffeomorphism. So that's actually what determines the diffeomorphism. Okay. So what Salen proposes to do is sorry. So that was the that was kind of the story, and in fact, we now want to apply Perlman's ideas to this setup. So Perlman's idea was that instead of just taking the extreme values for some functional like S of G phi, this S of G phi should be extremized relative to forcing the volume to be 1. So Perlman put an extra condition sort of on this space, restricting us to a subspace. Subspace being the places where the volume was identically 1. So in other words, sort of writing it out in these terms, we want to relate the dilaton and the metric by an equation of this sort. So it looks like a very innocuous change. And in fact, even if you had started out with no dilaton, this would let you choose a dilaton, adapt it to your metric, or adapt it to your family of metrics. But it has a very nice property with this problem. Namely, it converts what used to be a bilinear form that wasn't definite, which was determining the behaviors of the gradient function, into a bilinear form which is definite. So the typical way this gets implemented by in physics is to add a field which is the Lagrange multiplier for that condition. So I'll put in, I'll define a new action which looks like my old action plus this Lagrange multiplier times the volume of the manifold, the volume relative to that dilaton, right? Of the manifold, say, being equal to 1. And it just looks like this guy just looked like the integral of